You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
What is up, everybody, and welcome to the All-NBA Show, part of the All-City Podcast Network. I'm your host, Adam Matas. Legs still missing in action, but we got a great replacement for him today. A fellow tall from Bleacher Report, it's Andy Bailey.
Happy to be here. I appreciate that. I appreciate being referred to as a tall. I'll take that.
A fellow tall, man. I'm telling you, we might have the tallest podcast rotation in the entire NBA universe. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the Warriors. I hate to do this, Andy, because I feel like I'm talking about something I don't fully believe, but I'm going to try to talk myself into it. Maybe you can help talk me into it. The case for the Warriors making a Cinderella run, they're on a win streak, so you don't have to squint that hard to see it, but we're going to make the case for why they may be able to do that. Also, Joel Embiid's second game back looked a lot like the first one. 76ers get a win. Maxey this time was back and played great. We'll break that one down. The Nuggets fall to the Clippers. Mavs beat the Hawks. We'll get to all of that. And then the end-of-year awards later in the show. We're just going to kind of preview them and talk about the best races over there. But first, we are presented, as always, by DraftKings Sportsbook. Stay tuned because you'll hear more about DraftKings and all it has to offer throughout the show. DraftKings, the crown is yours. All right, Andy, let's start with the Warriors. This matchup, it kind of, like a week ago, this was circled on the calendar. This was going to be a big timer, Warriors Rockets. But the Rockets kind of dropped to where last night was the death knell. You thought maybe there's a chance they could get back into this and challenge the Warriors for that final play-in spot. But the Warriors on a heater right now, 6-game win streak. And last night's game to me feels a little bit like the Warriors know when the moment's there. They know when a game is big, and they showed up for it. The Rockets, we didn't know if they would. After the game, Ime Udoka certainly said they didn't show up for it. But yeah, this one felt like the team that was like, no. We know how to pull these wins out, and maybe a preview of things to come. What did you see from this game?
A lot of what you just said. Two or three weeks ago, Draymond said, I don't give a rats about the Rockets, or however he put it. And I remember thinking that's kind of brash. It's not necessarily surprising coming from Draymond, but Houston was on fire at that point. Yeah. I think they were maybe within a game or two. I know that Houston got to within a game at some point, but there is this sort of like organizational know-how or resilience built into the Warriors that's still just there. And that has shown up in the last couple weeks, particularly last night. They crush Houston in a game that essentially ends this Houston surge. I don't think there's any way it happens now. They're four back with six to go. And another thing I noticed as I was doing the power rankings for Bleacher Report last night, Golden State's been without Draymond for two different suspensions. They've had to figure out how to make Chris Paul work in this rotation. Klay Thompson's role has changed multiple times. They have the same net rating essentially as the Dallas Mavericks.
Wow.
And everybody's talking about Dallas now as like, you know, this is the big, scary potential foil for the Nuggets. Golden State, to me, they are starting to look like a team that can win a series or maybe even two, or let's get crazy, maybe even three. I don't know. Yeah. They've put themselves in a really tough position by being in the back half of the play-in. They're going to have to win back-to-back road games just to be in the playoffs. That's certainly not how you want to start your postseason run. But the last couple weeks have made me think, they've been doing this for 10 years, so maybe I never should have had them counted out in the first place.
So what I think you're referring to here is when you've seen a team do it before, even though this team is different than the one that has done it, but they have principal pieces. Whenever you see anything that's familiar, then you could say, well, at least I know that works. When they do that thing, I know it works at the highest levels. And I think that's the benefit of the doubt you're giving the Warriors here, is they're doing some things over this last 2 week run where it's like, yeah, that looks like the Warriors. It reminds me of what they did. They're defending well, getting out in transition, Steph Curry and Klay Thompson making threes. That's a formula we've seen and we're familiar with.
Yep.
If we get into the specifics of it, Trayce Jackson-Davis is the key to all of this, in my opinion. Last night, he goes 8 of 10 from the field. He's a plus 20. He gets 20 points, 5 rebounds, 4 assists, a steal, and a block. He's such a classic Warriors-type player. And I think the biggest thing is they no longer have a death lineup. So this idea of, like, Draymond Green at center obviously works in moments, but it's not the potent punch that it used to be, where it's like, oh, throw that lineup out for 6 minutes and you win the game. So they don't have that. So they have to figure out how to be better now when you go with a true center or a – where Draymond Green's not the small ball five. Trayce Jackson-Davis, to me, is the guy that allows that to happen. He's a really smart player. He's a mobile and versatile player. He allows them to play incredible defense against most teams, although I think probably not all teams, but against most teams and the ones they've been playing against. And to me, that's the difference. It almost allows the Warriors to look like the Warriors. Steph and Clay, now Wiggins is more of a perimeter player. Draymond Green is a roamer disruptor, and Trayce Jackson-Davis is almost in the Kevon Looney role now. And he's doing a really good job of it right now. To me, that's the key.
I'm glad you brought him up, because I totally agree with you. He is him and Podziemski, but I think to this point in the season, it's more Trayce Jackson-Davis has just been such a find for them in the draft. And Golden State has had they've had traditional centers that were important parts of multiple titles. I mean, Andrew Bogut was big early on. Kevon Looney has obviously been a big part of this for a while now. Trayce Jackson-Davis is that traditional five, but he's probably the most mobile one that they've had so far. So he kind of gives you a little bit of both worlds, where you can play a traditional five, have Draymond at the four, but you still have a lot of the defensive versatility and mobility that the old death lineups had. You know, it's not going to be quite as crazy, obviously, as Draymond and Iguodala and Durant and Curry and all that. But he does bring more versatility, I think, than some of the other traditional fives that they've had in the past. He's a huge find for them.
Yeah. And so do you buy him, though? Like, what are the limitations of him? Because some of this, I keep looking at this and I keep going, okay, this run, can they do this against everyone, or do they just run into the perfect teams that allow them to be good at the things they're good at?
Well, I think the limitations they're going to have are the things that I think have plagued them all season. Age is going to be a problem. They're not the guys that they were 5 years ago. That seems like kind of an obvious thing to say. One of the advantages of those death lineups with Draymond at the five was shooting at all five spots. Trayce Jackson-Davis doesn't give you that. And there's not necessarily a huge difference between, you know, four reliable shooters on the floor and five, but there is a difference.
Right.
And I don't know if we can call Draymond a reliable shooter either, although he shot it pretty well this season.
But no, we can't. We can't call
him that. I would like to pick nits with the Warriors, but there's so much more good happening than bad.
Yeah.
Right now, I think the easiest way to pick at their case is the position that they've put themselves in.
Right.
They, like I said earlier, they've got to survive the play-in, first of all. And that's that. The other three teams in the play-in are going to be really good. The West is absurd this season, as it has been for 25 years now. So there's no guarantee they get out of that. And then in the first round, they're probably going to have to play a hungry Timberwolves team, the Nuggets, or the Thunder. I think if you had to pick one that maybe they have a real good shot at, I would probably say the Thunder, just for lack of experience.
No,
but
and size. And lack of size, which I think is going to be one of their weaknesses, is if they just face
for
a team that's skilled size.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think maybe it's just the position they're in, I think, is the biggest weakness.
So let's go through it, because I wanted to make this case for them. Again, I don't believe it. So I don't want anybody saying, like, oh, come on. I don't think it's going to happen, but at the same time, I do have an enormous amount of respect for Steph and for what the Warriors have, and even for Draymond and what they've accomplished. So,
and let me interject real quick, Adam, too, before you make that case. Another point on the West is there are legitimately 7 or 8 teams you could make a reasonable case for getting to the conference finals. That's how that's how random, chaotic, and good the West is.
Right. And that chaos is probably going to come in, you know, we're going to see it throughout this playoffs. I mean, even the first round, we don't know what the matchups are, but you're going to look at it. And I just know there's going to be a lot of, like, when the experts pick, there's going to be a lot of series where it's like 50-50, you know, half the people are on one side, half the people on the other. So let's look at it. Here's the first thing is they're not going to move up from the 10 spot. So they're going to be stuck there. And if you face the Lakers in the first round, I don't like that matchup for them. Even though I believe they're 2-1 against the Lakers, they have one more to go as well. So they're 2-1 against the Lakers. One of the losses was in overtime, or the one loss was in overtime. Draymond Green was a +31 in that game, by the way, the game they lost in overtime. And both teams were relatively at full strength. Now, so you could say that at least this year, when those teams have matched up, they've been mostly at full strength and the Warriors have won those matchups. But I still think that's one where you get into a playoff and one, LeBron versus Steph. We saw this last year. You know, that's always brings out the best in both guys. And then the size factor of an Anthony Davis and even of a LeBron, I just feel like that would overwhelm the Warriors. So I don't love that one. I think their case for a Cinderella's run starts with the Lakers might beat the Kings. They're only a half game behind them. The Kings are a little bit in free fall. And if you get a matchup that's this wounded Kings missing Monk and Herder against the Warriors, there's a psychological edge to it. On both accounts, both that the Warriors have owned them historically, and then two, the Kings were just in the 5 seed like 3 weeks ago in their fall. That's always a tough psychological place to be. So I think Monk, their case starts with that.
And Monk is like a psychological fire starter for them too. He's totally. a really important loss.
I think Herter's an important loss too, just because with the Warriors with the Kings, you're going to need the spacing. So when you lose two guys that provide. I mean, Monk provides a bunch of other stuff, but just that provides spacing, it becomes harder to put lineups. And we've seen that with Duarte and some of the lineups that they put out there. It's like, yeah, it's really hard to have good spacing for 48 minutes when you're missing two of your best 3-point shooters. So I look at that one and I go, Warriors on the road in Sacramento. I think I would take the Warriors if you got there. And that's the first piece of all of this. Would you take, if that matched up, Warriors at Kings in the 9-8, who would you pick?
I was just about to say, if that winds up being the matchup, I feel like people would overwhelmingly pick the Warriors based on where the Kings are at right now. They're not like plummeting down the standings, but you mentioned they were in fifth fairly recently. So they're falling, they're hurt. And there's the history too. And so I think it would be pretty, like, I think I'd feel fairly confident picking the Warriors there.
I think I would too. You know, and it's also hard to play the underdog when you're the home team, which is what the Kings would almost need to be in that moment. They would need to feel like underdogs, but you're going to be at home. So it's a tough spot to be in. And then the other part of this, if we're talking Cinderella runs, I think you would want probably New Orleans, who's also, by the way, wounded. Who knows if Ingram will be back for that game theoretically or not. But even if he is, there's always the weirdness. That team is always had these little fits and starts because of guys coming in and out of the lineup. And every time one guy comes back, it feels like there's a little, okay, we have to reacclimate ourselves period. If they're doing that going into a play-in, that would be really tough. So I think your next thing would be, okay, the Lakers move up to 8. They beat the Pelicans. And now you beat the Kings and you have the Pelicans number 2. It's not an easy one. It is a weird size versus, you know, versatility matchup. But that's the thing the Warriors, I think, the Warriors have the experience. And that would be a really tough spot for New Orleans to find themselves in.
Yeah, and you would think that they'd be feeling a little momentum coming off of a win against Sacramento in the first game. That's another one I feel like I'd be fairly confident picking the Warriors. Unless, you know, Ingram's back or Zion is coming off a huge game. But if they're playing the Pelicans, that means the Pelicans lost in the first one. So you're probably concerned about something you saw in that game too.
I agree. So there you go. That's your argument here. I think that's the best path. And to be honest with you, it's kind of a likely one, I think. It's possible it's the Suns that fall to the Pelicans because the Suns have a pretty brutal last 5 games of the season. So it's possible that that happens. And look, Warrior Suns in and of itself, KD and Steph, that game almost just feels like, you know, cocaine or something. Like, throw everything out the window. This game's just going to be an insanity, and who knows how it'll go. So there's a case even if that happens. But let's just say the best case, I think, is New Orleans. Now, here's where it gets interesting. If you do get to the 8 seed then and you win the play-in and you get up, I think the Timberwolves would be a really tough matchup. You're right that there's this experience thing. You're right that there is this – there's a Draymond Green, Rudy Gobert element to this that's like a little wild. Who knows what would happen in a series of Draymond Green and Rudy Gobert, you know, after all that's gone on. I think that would add something to it. I would pick the Wolves pretty handily in that. So I think that's a bad matchup. And if it was Denver, I think that one would even be more overwhelming. The case would be if the Thunder can somehow, and it's actually not that crazy, they're only one game back. If the Thunder line up a one seed, I just feel like that's such a perfect, perfect situation for the Warriors to be in. I'm not saying they'd beat the Thunder. I would still pick the Thunder because the Thunder are really freaking good. But if you're wanting a chance to try to steal a game early and get and retake momentum, that's the team that I look at and I go, yeah, they can't exploit you the same ways that the big teams can.
Yeah, I hate to just agree with everything that you say, but I'm in the same place. I wouldn't even pretend to make a case for Golden State over Minnesota or Denver. Maybe Minnesota, but I do think either one of those teams would beat the Warriors fairly handily. I mean, there's a reason they're in 10th, and I would probably pick the Thunder too if it came down to that being a 1-8 matchup.
Me too.
But that one would certainly surprise me a lot less if Golden State emerged from that series with a win. None of those guys have playoff experience. I think Shai Gilgeous-Alexander may have been in the playoffs as a rookie, where he had an obviously much different role with the Los Angeles Clippers than he does now. So that's going to be a whole new ball game for every single guy on that roster. And it's not a new ball game for most of the Warriors, or at least the key pieces, like you mentioned earlier. So that wouldn't shock me to see them beat the Thunder in a series. And then at that point, you're thinking they've got momentum on their side. They've been through playoff runs. Every round, the number of teams left is cut in half. So, you know, maybe they play a banged up Clippers team in the second round. Like, once dominoes start falling, I think in Golden State's case, the initial dominoes are going to be really hard to push over.
Yeah.
But if they can get those down, then maybe we can start to entertain, like, is this the last dance for them?
Right. And it does mirror a lot of those last dances that you've seen where it's like pure chaos in that final year. Everybody knows it's the final year. Everything's going wild, and there's a weird, like, we were, what's the Bane line? Like, the Warriors would have been born in the storm, so to speak. So by the time you got to the playoffs, they're like, dude, we've been in this all year. Our year's been chaos and on a knife's edge. So they're comfortable in those moments. Again, I'm giving the half-hearted sell here because I don't really believe it's going to happen. But, you know, I have a lot of respect. Thunder fans have been upset with me a little bit this year because I've raised some of the things that I think why I think that the playoffs will be challenging in unique ways for them. And the reason I say this is because every player, every coach, every GM says the same thing. Anytime you ever ask them about the playoffs, it's like, yeah, it's different and you have to experience it and you don't know how teams will react to it. So if I hear everybody say that, and with my own eyes, I watch every single year last year's Kings, or, you know, you watch it and you go, hey, it's not that they're not good. It's that there's lessons sometimes you can only learn through experience. And the Thunder are going to have to learn those this year, and they might learn them on the fly quick enough to just win, and they don't need the learning curve, but there's a chance that they will. So that's why I think it's interesting. The Warriors, would it be good? Would you enjoy one last little hurrah for Steph and the Warriors making a little run?
I think I would. I've been on the Stephen Curry is top 10 all time train for 5 years now. So everything he adds is like a little bit of validation to me. I certainly wouldn't mind seeing him win one more. He's one of the two or three most entertaining players of my lifetime. So I've you know, there's still times like last night with the Rockets game, there are still times where I'll be sitting down watching the Warriors and just thinking, few teams entertain me quite like Curry's Warriors. So yeah, I would totally be down with another run.
I would as well. All right, we're not picking it, but it was worth talking about. And the Warriors, it's like under the radar that it's happened over this last 2 week stretch, but they are absolutely on fire and playing really, really good defense and winning some games. So we'll see if they can keep it up here as we go. All right, let's take a break. On the other side, Joel Embiid, second game back, looks pretty impressive. He's scoring over a point a minute. We're going to talk about that, as well as the Clippers beating the Nuggets and the Mavs. All of that on the other side. But first, it's Friday. It's opening day in a lot of cities. I know it is here in Denver. Are you looking for last-minute tickets? Well, hop on the Game Time app. They have the lowest prices. They've got deals, flash deals, zone deals, and they also have that all-in pricing feature where you can know exactly what the price is before you check out. You don't have to go through everything and enter your credit card and address and everything else. Then you get to the end, and it was $100 more than you thought. All-in pricing tells you right away so you don't waste your time. They also, it's a great way for you to peruse and just find out what's going on in your neck of the woods, what events are going on, festivals or games. You might not have even known of something going on, and you hop on the Game Time app and you're like, wow, I didn't know that comedian was in town. All right, let me pick up some tickets and I'll go check it out. So take the guesswork out of buying tickets with Game Time. Download the Game Time app, create an account, and use code ALLNBA for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply. Again, create an account, redeem code ALLNBA for $20 off. Last minute tickets, lowest prices guaranteed. Also, want to tell you about the DraftKings Sportsbook app. This weekend, we're going to be talking about it at the very end, but March Mania is here, the Final Four. My NC State Wolfpack. DraftKings Sportsbook, one of America's top-rated sportsbook app, is giving new customers a shot at $5 to turn $5 into $150 instantly in bonus bets with any college basketball bet. Probably going to go UConn. If I were betting this weekend, I'd probably go UConn and Purdue, but I'm going to go with my heart and lay some money down on my Wolfpack just because it's more fun, and if I hit it, it'll feel extra good. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code ALLNBA. New customers bet $5 and get $150 instantly in bonus bets, whether you win or lose, with code ALLNBA. The crown is yours.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Or in West Virginia, visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas, 21 and over, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.co/b. Ball for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
All right, back here, segment two. I'm with Bleacher Report's Andy Bailey. Let's move on now to the Eastern Conference, where the 76ers took care of the Miami Heat last night. This was an interesting one. The 76ers were ahead for most of the game. Miami Heat, I think, had a 17-0 run in the second half. So the Philadelphia 76ers, after leading and blowing the lead, had to come back in this one. But they did, thanks in part to, or in large part to, Tyrese Maxey, who went for 37 points, 9 rebounds, 11 assists. Maybe his best game since that first game Embiid went down and he dropped 50. What did you see from this one, Andy?
Well, Maxey obviously stands out. And it's an obvious thing to say, but he faces such a different defensive challenge when Embiid is playing, as opposed to when Embiid's not. Like you said, he had a huge first game after Embiid went down. But I think over the last several weeks, the offensive load of having to be the guy for as long as he was starting to wear on him a little bit. And last night, he makes well over half of his shots, 11 assists, like you mentioned. When a defense has to key in as much as it does on Embiid in the middle of the floor, around the free throw line, it's just going to make Maxey's life a lot better. I mean, shocking revelation. The Sixers are better when Joel Embiid plays. He hasn't shot the ball. Embiid's played two games so far. He hasn't been over 50% in either of them. But he looks pretty good to me. I mean, given – I feel like he came back fairly quickly from the meniscus tear.
Yeah,
it was like 8 weeks or something. Feels like shorter end of the timeline. It may take him a little bit of time to get back on track. He's shooting a lot of jumpers right now, which is not totally unusual, but he does seem a little more reliant on it than he was beforehand. But I think even if he's, you know, if he's 95% of what he was before the injury, they're sort of the chaos agent in the East. I think it's a little bit easier to go chalk with the East than it is in the West. But the fact that you've got the Sixers now hovering in the play-in mix, that's something that could potentially shake a lot of stuff up.
So I got to share a text from Legs last night. Last night during this game, and I think it was right at the end of it, he texts me and he says, I'm telling you right now, I'm picking the Sixers to beat anyone they play in a series besides Boston. So wow. He was feeling it last night as he was watching this team. That text might have actually come like in the early third quarter when the 76ers really looked great. They kind of limped to the finish line a little bit in this one. So I'm curious when Legs gets back, I know we'll be talking about this one, but just to kind of tease for everybody, he certainly loves the way the 76ers upside looks. But here's the question I have. You're right. I mean, Embiid, the thing that stood out to me this year, by far Embiid's best season, he was dominant before he got hurt, absolutely dominant.
This was, yeah, agreed.
And he was dominant, though. It really was more jumpers than I think the people would realize. Like, he was so comfortable with his jumper, was able to get to it better than ever, just creating space without even just jab steps and with the threat of, you know, if you get too close, he was so good at driving past you or creating contact. So he was so comfortable getting that shot, and he was taking it. But you're right that now through two games, that jumper has been looking good, although he missed, like, his last seven or eight shots in this game. He maybe wore it down a little bit. But he's going to it almost exclusively. And that's the thing that I'm curious about going forward is before you could pressure him because you were, or you couldn't pressure him because you were afraid of drawing those fouls. I'm curious if the injury, if that's the thing that guys learn eventually is just get into a space. He doesn't have the same explosion or conditioning or any of that stuff to beat you that way. That's something that we don't know yet. And I'm curious to see if teams try that over this last five games.
Yeah, it'll be, I'm curious about that. I'm also curious to see how much the officiating adjustment applies to him in the same way.
I saw you on the timeline last night. Yeah.
I think it was Raheem Palmer from The Ringer said if Joel Embiid's getting the pre-February 2024 whistle and the rest of the league is getting the post one, we're in trouble. His first game back, he had 12 free throws. And I thought, what's like riding a bike for him? But
25 last night.
Yeah, it was a different story last night. I think Miami made a concerted effort not to put their hand in the cookie jar. He's become very reliable as a mid-range shooter, especially before the injury. He almost has like a little bit of a fadeaway to most of his jumpers too. The fact that he's 7 foot tall and he's got a little bit of a lean back makes it so difficult to guard. And when he's hitting that consistently, I mean, there's not a whole lot that you can do, but you would certainly prefer tons of those jumpers to, you know, 13, 14 trips to the line, 100%. Five dunks and five or six of the jumpers. So if teams, again, Miami lost this game. If teams can follow whatever blueprint they did to keep him off the line and keep him, you know, outside the paint, maybe that's the key. And maybe this is the only opportunity you're going to get to do it, as he's maybe a little bit uncomfortable coming off of a knee injury.
Yeah. So that's the way I would put it. It's like every boxer, you have to have the punch and the counterpunch. If you only have one, eventually you're going to get found out. And I think that burst, like with Joel Embiid, the pump fake, and all of a sudden you bit a little too much, and now he's going. I think, again, if I'm going to play devil's advocate here, I think that Embiid truly is good at drawing fouls. Like, this is not a crazy thing to say. He really is good at knowing exactly how to get the contact and how to get a person off balance, and then rather than go around
them,
if you reach your arm out, that's a big part of it, right? Is he'll constantly kind of like shot fake a little just to kind of keep your hands out of his reach. But even if he gets you with the shot fake to where you step up, he's really good at the first step. And it's not always a first step to go around. It's often to go like through to get the contact or what have you and then put the shot up. So he's very, very skilled at that role. So, but that's the counterpunch. But doing that takes a lot of energy, especially for a guy his size. I mean, his energy reserves get used up, I think, just because of sheer size, they get used up quicker than almost anybody in the league. And so you settle for jumpers when that option is too tiring. And that's the thing I just want to see going forward. Now, we had Devon Givens on of PHLY yesterday, and we were talking about how this schedule is perfect for them because they play almost exclusively tanking teams from here on out, which will help them win and maybe get a rhythm. But the downside of that is I'm not sure how motivated those teams will be to test this theory. I'm not sure how much the coaches are going to be like, hey, pressure him. He's tired. Let's get into his space and make him drive. I just don't think the teams that they're playing, Memphis and stuff, are going to be even thinking to do that.
Yeah, you're probably right. And so there's less reps for Embiid to figure out what this is going to be like going into the playoffs. I think there's maybe a balancing act for that. It might be a good thing that he gets five easy games and can just sort of ease his way into this. But we were talking earlier about how much different the regular season and the postseason are. And if he goes from 4, 5, 6, you know, relatively low stakes, low intensity games to all of a sudden he's in the play-in.
Do or die.
Or all of a sudden, or all of a sudden he's in the 6-3 matchup. That's going to be a rapid change in intensity. And that could be difficult to adjust to.
Let's talk about the other games here real quickly. The Nuggets fall to the Clippers. Jokic had an opportunity at a game winner, a runner, basically a 30-foot runner at the end, came up just a little bit short. Here's what stood out to me. You watch a lot of Nuggets, so I know you can speak to them. Here's what stood out to me. PJ Tucker played 17 minutes. He didn't score, but he did a good job of battling Jokic, at least for a period. He was a minus 12 in this game, so how good could he have possibly been? But when you look at them, it was noteworthy to me that they didn't play a ton of minutes. They didn't play Tice. They didn't play a ton of minutes with like Plumlee. He had just got 13 minutes. PJ Tucker, to me, might be a guy that if they do match up in the second round of a playoffs, which is possible, they might play PJ Tucker a lot of minutes, somebody who's not been in the rotation.
Yeah, and I guess people who follow me on Twitter won't be surprised to hear this. I talk a lot about officiating. And one of the keys with Jokic might just be playing a smaller guy on him, because whether the league wants to admit it or not, a player like PJ Tucker has way more leeway than like even Ivica Zubac. Because he's 6-7 inches shorter than Jokic. He's already developed this reputation as being a hard-nosed physical defender. And, you know, this we saw this when he was with the Sixers too. He relishes the opportunity to go out there and just beat the heck out of Jokic. And if they're not going to call it, you can't really fault PJ Tucker for playing as physically as he does.
Of course.
And I don't think it necessarily bothers Jokic. He still finished with a triple double and he was a plus 12 in the game. But certainly it's got to have, at least a bit of frustration that he's got to be feeling when he's being defended like that. If you've got like a gritty, hard-nosed defender, you're nobody's going to completely stop Jokic. Like, he's figured out every matchup, every puzzle over the course of his career. But if you've got a guy who can just like make things physically hard on him, wear down his body a little bit over the course of a series, if PJ Tucker can do that 15 minutes a game for, 4 or 5 games in a series, that could be enough of a margin to make it, winnable for the Clippers.
It's just body, like having bodies to throw. Zubac does a good job on Jokic. Obviously dominates the matchup, but you're just talking about guys that can just take a little piece out of Jokic. He does that at a good job of that. And then if PJ Tucker, who's so different, by the way, it just gives another pitch. It's like having two pitches to throw at a great hitter. Right. So it just gives him something else. And while I think that Jokic would overcome PJ Tucker and probably make that untenable in short order in a playoff series, your best bet is pissing Jokic off, because he becomes a worse player when he gets pissed off. He's gotten better at not being pissed off as he's gotten more mature and more and older. But PJ Tucker and Draymond Green are the two guys that seem to be allowed the most physicality. They get away with the most against Jokic, and both guys can really get under his skin when he's not zero in focused on, hey, I just have to accept that that's the challenge tonight. The other game that we'll talk about, I know you were locked into the Mavericks beating the Hawks 109-95. What stood out to you about this one?
This game was interesting because it was very much a defensive win for the Mavericks, which is, that's just interesting in general with Dallas over the last couple of years. They've never been known for defense. And I think, you know, especially since they picked up Gafford and PJ Washington, and Gafford didn't, I was going to say, I'm not sure he played, but I think he might've gone out at some point in that game. He played 23 minutes. Yeah. That extra dose of size and athleticism from those two guys has made a huge difference defensively. PJ Washington, I think, Gafford has gotten more of the attention, and I think understandably so. Like, he's a good rim protector. He fits really well as a rim runner with Luka. But PJ Washington has been this sort of switchable, versatile defender that I think has added a lot to them defensively. There's, you know, they've gotten a lot of attention and a lot of talk over the last several weeks. They've been really, really good, obviously. Their defense is – that makes them very interesting to me, the fact that they can now play plus defensive games. And Atlanta's not a bad offensive team either. To hold them under 100, I think is pretty impressive.
I agree. What about PJ Washington, though? Because we think about the matchups that he's going to have in a post in the playoffs. So if you go to the Clippers, you're going to have to slow down one of their wing scorers. Like, you're going to have to make a major impact. Do you think he is up for that challenge?
I'm going to say yes. And I'm also, what I will also say is he's certainly more up for it than what they had before. I think Grant Williams is an okay defender. PJ Washington is longer. He's more athletic. I've seen a lot of matchups with him defensively where he looks, you know, very locked in. I don't think he can completely take away a guy like Kawhi if he's healthy, or Paul George. But with him and Derek Jones, both in the starting five, I think he can at least frustrate those wings. I think they're much better equipped to handle a team like that than they were 2 months ago or whatever it was.
I agree. We're high on the Mavericks over here, but I do like the point about it being a defensive win. They need to be able to win those types of games. And even though they scored 109, you know, holding a team under 100 points in today's day and age is impressive.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
All right, let's go to these end of year awards. We're actually next week, Tim Legs and I are going to be recording his official ballot, my official ballot. But so we will have an awards, end of year awards special that we release sometime next week. But I wanted to preview just what was interesting about these races, not necessarily make predictions, although we can do that if you want here, Andy. But I wanted to just talk about what are the most interesting ones. Let's start with MVP. And we're obviously using our partners, DraftKings. We're using their odds here. What would you guess off the top of your head? I don't know if you've looked at this. What would you guess Jokic's odds are? Have you already looked?
I have them pulled up.
I spoiled it. There you go. Minus 3,500 for Jokic to win? That tells me that this is over. I mean, Vegas doesn't get things that wrong.
It's over. And do you know how dramatically they shifted before and after that ESPN straw poll?
How much?
Maybe I should have had the answer to that before I asked you, but it was big. We use a different book at Bleacher Report for our odds. But I think he was like, I think he went from like minus 500 to minus 2,000 upon the release of the straw poll. Yeah. I think there was a lot of people coming for Luka Doncic for a couple weeks right up until that straw poll came out, understandably so. Like, he was on a crazy heater and the Mavericks were climbing the standings. Even as that was going on, I kept thinking, you know, based on the things that that are important to me in a most valuable player discussion, it was still Jokic. To see how overwhelmingly he won that straw poll, I think the books basically shut it down after that. I mean, this these are odds that that they might as well turn it off.
Well, Luka, by the way, is number two, plus 1,600. Shea is third at plus 2,000. So I think that's pretty interesting as well to kind of see in there. And sometimes those things are important because they do set the stage for future years. Like Luka, you know, if he gets, should he get even a second place finish, as disappointing as it might be for Mavs fans, it sets the tone for, he would probably be favored pretty heavily going into next season, I would think. So there is something to that. But minus 3,500 is wild. I will say this, the straw poll has been such a strong indicator for the last, I don't know how long it's been, 4 years. The ESPN NBA straw poll that Tim Bontemps does, and of which I participate in. I wonder if there's cycles to these types of things. It has created consensus in a way that I actually think is bad for the NBA. I like when there's different opinions.
Yeah.
I think that one, every voter kind of looks around and says, oh my God, 85% of Jokic, I had Shea, maybe I'm wrong. I'll change my vote so I don't look like an idiot. I think there's a little bit of that going on, but I also wonder if that has a shelf life to where voters now are, forget the straw poll. Like, they're almost aware of the fact that it could create consensus and are more inclined now to say, don't let that affect your judgment. I feel like there's a cycle to those things. And I think that this vote will reflect that. Even though I think Jokic will win overwhelmingly, I don't think it'll be 85% of the vote the way the straw poll is.
I do think there's something to what you're saying. And I also think that this year, really more than any from the last 3, 4, 5 years, is kind of wide open. Like, I think Jokic has the strongest MVP case, but there are decent two very strong cases for multiple other guys. Like, I think in the middle of the season, I could have made a very strong case for Shea Gilgeous-Alexander. More recently, Luka Doncic, and obviously Giannis has just been kind of lingering the whole time. Early in the season, I actually felt like Joel Embiid had a better MVP case than he did last year.
Early, if he didn't get hurt, I think Embiid would have won in a landslide.
I totally agree. I think that he had taken a huge step forward from what he did last season. So it is a year where I think people would have been open to like a lot of different votes. But yeah. Jokic has survived a lot of wars of attrition over the last 3 or 4 years. The NBA season is long. We've seen SGA start to miss games here recently. That might help Luka finish second. But Jokic is just such a constant, where some of these other guys, there's so many, you know, ups and downs and peaks and valleys, where he's just Jokic for 75 games every year. And I'm with you. I think he's going to win it pretty comfortably, but there will be a decent number of other first place votes.
Yeah, I think so too. Let's go to the more interesting ones, because I don't think that one's too interesting. All right, most improved player. This one's so interesting to me. The odds: Maxey currently leads minus 200. He's the favorite. Kobe White plus 150 right after him. And then the guy that I would pick in a landslide if I were picking, Jalen Williams at plus 3,000. Here's my case for this award. And this is a tough one, right? Because when did a player improve? Did they start improving at the end of last year? Like, it's just so hard to quantify. Jalen Williams at the start of the year, and I remember it very vividly because I was on the Jalen Williams like hype. He was one of my guys coming into the year. And within a month, he could no longer be one of my guys because he had made it, right? Like, your guys are the guys that you're like, this guy will be next. He became next so quickly that I think people almost take for granted the fact that the guy is knocking on the door of like superstardom, in my opinion. That's how good of a player he is. And that was not something people were saying in the offseason. To me, that is an enormous leap. Forget what the numbers say. I look at that and I go, as great as Chet is, they have a 1-2 punch right now that is Shea and Jalen Williams. And that is why the Thunder are contending for the one seed. So for me, that would be it. But the book reflects that it's almost impossible.
I won't tip my hand on what I think about this question, but what do you think about the first, like, you can't give it to a second year guy theory with most improved player?
I think I understand that argument. I think it's, I think that that probably should factor into it a little bit. It is weird though. Like, he was an older rookie, so you don't want to have to wait 3 years the way you would. I think that part of it can get a little bit clouded. I would say for the sake of, I think it makes it more complicated to not allow a second-year player to try to handicap him. So if, unless you're going to make a rule that it can't be a second-year player, I think you can't factor that in.
I think the word factor is what it should be. I don't think they should be ruled out entirely. It's not like they, like, he's still improving from year one to year two. Just because year one to year two players are expected to improve, that doesn't negate the fact that, like, he still improved way more than most rookie to sophomore.
Yeah, right. In fact, there's a sophomore slump. We have this phrase, sophomore slump, because not every second year player makes that leap. Oftentimes, there's this learning curve. For J Dub, that's not the case. He is a star now in this league and the potential to be a superstar in the league.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that he has a good case. I actually like Coby White the best.
He's had since the change.
Yeah, since Zach LaVine left the rotation entirely. I mean, he's been good all season, but I think that maybe empowered him a little bit once Zach LaVine left the rotation entirely. Prior to this season, I think if you had asked just about any analyst or fan, like, what is the ceiling of Coby White? I think it was like a heat check scorer off the bench, like a Jamal Crawford, Lou Williams type. And that's, you know, that's like the ceiling of that player archetype, those two guys. He is, he's been a much better, like, you know, selective shooter this season than I think he has in years past. He's been a better playmaker. I think he's competed defensively. You know, the Bulls aren't, you know, they're not the most exciting and the best team in the NBA, but he's been really fun for me to watch this season. I think, and he's basically doubled his scoring average. You know, not to reduce everything down to points per game and who had the biggest jumps in each category, but doubling your points per game, that's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a really big deal. Let's go to the other one. Coach of the year is interesting to me. So Dagnod is -260. He's the favorite. Finch is +300. After that, you have Mosley at +700, and that's pretty much it. Mazzulla at +3,500 is pretty much out of this. So you have three young coaches, three upstart teams, Dagnott, Finch, and Mosley. And I kind of find it funny that Mosley is so far behind everyone else. Because I think these three almost put to me in the same category, and you could have separation, you know, first, second, third, but that feels like a little too much separation. I really like Mosley.
That feels like too much separation to me, too. Dagnall gets some credit for this, but he does have an MVP candidate. I mean, certainly his coaching helps SGA a little bit.
No question.
But having a superstar player, a superstar talent, goes a long way for the coach too. And Chris Finch has multiple star talents. He's got Anthony Edwards, who's been this ascending all season. Karl-Anthony Towns made an all-star team this year. I mean, they're not the same level as SGA.
Well, Gobert is, though, right? Defensive player of the year candidate.
Gobert is a superstar.
Defense, so, yeah.
He's going to win, you know, not to spoiler alert, he's probably going to win defensive player of the year. Mosley, I think the Magic cleared their preseason over-under by like 8 or 9 wins already. Yeah. I know Paolo Banchero made an all-star team, but I don't know how confident I'd be saying anyone on the Magic is like a top 35 player in the NBA right now. And they've had a stellar defense all season long. They're within striking distance of second in the Eastern Conference. There's a little bit more coaching behind Orlando's success than I think maybe there is with Minnesota or OKC.
People need to watch Mosley coach. Like, he, in person, he is the most interesting coach because he is nonstop. He's an old school, almost college coach in how intense he is. Like, he burns 2,000 calories a game coaching. that's how intense he is with it. And so, and I kind of like it because the players seem to respond to it. And you're right, man, that's a flawed roster. They have great players, but they have, they're lacking a lot of things that are pretty important to winning and that they keep winning. So yep. I think he deserves a lot of credit, but I do like the Dagnott pinch or pick. Look, he's incredible. Finch, I understand it. I actually think that might be my order. I just would have shortened the odds to maybe I would have had it like minus 150, plus 150, plus 300. That's probably like how personally I would have wanted to handicap that one. Sixth man of the year, another one that's tough. Malik Monk, minus 125, RIP. Naz Reid, minus 105. That's pretty much the battle. Norman Powell is way out there. So this one's, what's interesting about this one is sixth man of the year is almost always Malik Monk, like the Malik Monk of that year. It's almost always that. Naz Reid is such a rare example of a center version of, he's the center Malik Monk.
Montrezl Harrell won it however many years ago that was, but it is it is exceptionally rare. I mean, it's typically, I think people have joked in the past, it should just be named the who scored the most points off the bench award. Yeah. Here's my hot take. I told you this before we started recording.
Yeah, wait.
Sixth man of the year is, I'm pretty sure, one of the awards that you don't have to have the 65 game minimum for. Somebody may need to check me on that. But last time I mean, it's a little bit, he's come down to earth a little bit now that I'm looking at the numbers.
Don't hedge your bet. I want to hear it. Who is it?
I think there's a case for Jonathan Isaac.
Oh, yeah. This isn't crazy at all. Just the games played is the hard part.
Games played is huge for him. For some reason, I thought he led all these candidates in plus minus, but he's almost 100 behind Naz Reid. That doesn't necessarily my case. Orlando's net rating is like dramatically better when he's on the floor. Per possession, he's one of the top, I think, four or five defenders in the NBA this season. And yeah, he's kind of coming around.
I would maybe go higher. Like, you have your two MVP, your two defensive player of the year candidates. And then after that, Jonathan Isaac has been that impactful.
He's been ridiculous. And I feel like his offense has started to come around here in the last couple of months too. So when I actually just discovered, I think like a week ago, that that rule doesn't apply to sixth man of the year. And that's when it first like clicked in my head. Well, why isn't there at least a case for Jonathan Isaac? I'm not sure it's as strong as the one for Monk or Naz Reid. But he's had a massive, massive impact on that Magic team. And he's a huge part of why they're in the hunt for second.
That guy, if he can stay healthy, and look, it's still possible he stays healthy. Like, some guys are injured for most of their first few years, and then they're not, it doesn't stick with them. I mean, knock on wood, I hope that happens, because that guy is a major impact defender. Like, there's guys that are championship pieces. He's a championship piece, no question in my mind, because of the impact he makes defensively. I like that hot take. I think Naz Reid, though, if we're just going off of what we think could happen, Naz Reid has a real case, because it's not just the scoring. Like, it's also the difference between the Monk, Jamal Crawford mold of players is that every team in theory has guys that physically match up with those guys. Naz Reid is the type of guy that there's just some teams that don't have a backup center, that don't have a backup big. And so it compromises you in a whole new way of like, well, we can't play our regular rotation. We have to put out this other guy that we don't even like playing, but we just need another body. And Naz Reid provides that. And I think that's an underrated asset to have, the ability to make another team play someone who's not in their 82-game rotation.
I looked this up the other day. I can't it was probably for some article, but the Timberwolves are plus 9.7 points per 100 possessions with Edwards, Gobert, and Towns on the floor. And then that number, spinning wheel, this is riveting podcast content. Plus 19.0 when you switch Reid in for Towns. And there's, you know,
sample there's size some, and who they're going against.
The sample size is still 1,000-plus possessions, which is pretty good, but it's about half of the one with Towns. And there's certainly some minutes in there where they're playing reserves. But Naz Reid has been fantastic. He does a lot of the things that Karl-Anthony Towns does without taking the ball out of Anthony Edwards' hands quite as much. And I think he's certainly a more mobile and versatile defender.
Yeah. Real quickly here, because we got to wrap up. Defensive player of the year, Gobert -3,000, Wemby +1,000. I feel like it's a win for Wemby that he has the second shortest odds. I think it's just a win and sets the table for the rest of his career. Just real quickly, is there, like, people are making the case, and here's what I'll say. Wembanyama in the last month of the season made a bigger defensive impact than anybody in the NBA. And maybe, and I'm saying a month, but it might be it's 2 months. I didn't watch the Spurs every game, but maybe it was 2 months. That guy's peak this year was a higher defensive peak than Rudy Gobert's. Gobert just does it every game against everybody, and he does it at such a ridiculous high level. They have the, you know, one of the top defenses. So to me, it's clearly going to be Gobert. But at least if you just said, if you looked at the curve, at some point in the season, I think Wemby actually became the single most dominant defensive force in the league.
I do not disagree. I just looked this up as you were talking. He's fourth in defensive estimated plus minus this season.
Wemby is?
Yeah. And Jonathan Isaac is first. And
oh, look at that.
Before I made my take. So yeah, Wemby's peak is insane defensively. I never thought there was much real momentum to him winning Defensive Player of the Year. It's just hard when your team is that bad defensively. But they haven't been a dumpster fire defensively when he's on the floor.
Yeah.
So I mean, maybe there's a case to be made for him, but I think it's pretty clearly Gobert.
You imagine a team. Somebody needs to put together Jaden McDaniels, Herb Jones, Jonathan Isaac, and Wembanyama. They'd win every game 48-43. You know, it would set basketball back 1,000 years. But whatever.
Welcome back to the early 2000s.
Yeah, I'm gonna skip Clutch Player of the Year because I don't really care, and that one's a little bit too esoteric. We got to wrap up anyway. So I'm gonna go to.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
Our DraftKings Who Won the Week segment. Every Friday we get to this. We ask who won the week. Andy, I give you a list of nominees, and you're going to have to be the one to pick. I'm going to start where we just left off, which is Victor Wembanyama this week. 31.7 points per game, 14.7 rebounds per game, 6.7 assists per game, 2.3 steals, 4.3 blocks. What the heck is that stat line, man, for That's a rookie crazy. Player? Here's my hot take on Wemby. I'm not trying to say he's not a great player. He's clearly a great player. His stats are going to be so hard to quantify in the years to come, because that stat line right there is like first ballot Hall of Fame. That's if that bonkers. Was your apex of your career, and he's doing that just in some random week, his rookie season, it's almost going to be hard to quantify how good and impactful he is, because his numbers are certain to reflect that almost every single night in the coming years.
Yeah, I don't know what to say about Wembanyama's numbers at this point. Everybody keeps making this point here recently, and it's kind of scary to think about. Like, this is probably the worst stat line he's going to have in the next like 10 to 15 years.
Doesn't make sense. 32, 15, and 7?
It's crazy. Well, even if you just look at his season-long rookie stats, like they kind of blow your mind, and he's going to get, you know, 20 to 25% better statistically over the next few years. It's crazy.
And then, you know, six stocks, 6.5. Just insane. Devin Booker had himself a week, 35.5 points per game. He shot 58, 48, 91 splits. So you could add him to the list as well. Joel Embiid comes back from injury, which is a huge thing. And he plays well in his return, over a point per minute, to go with 5 rebounds, 5 assists. And then the Warriors as a team, they go 4-0. They all but clinched their spot in the play-in. We thought they might fall out. They didn't. And they had wins over Houston and over Dallas. So if you had to pick between those four, where would you go?
I'm going to go with Wemby. The crazy numbers. The fact that he is like showing up in all these defensive player of the year conversations all of a sudden, the fact that he's already making the Spurs competitive, like they're still losing a lot of games the last several weeks, but they're keeping it close with a lot of good teams here lately. He is going to speed up the Spurs timeline, whether they want to or not. I'm sure the organization wouldn't mind if they were terrible again next year and they got a shot at like Ace Bailey and Cooper Flagg in the next draft.
Oh man, come on.
But Wemby, he's already like, you know, the thing where I kind of put all the advanced numbers together into one stew.
Yeah.
He's already a top 15 to 20 player by that exercise and has been for the last couple months. Like, I'm fine saying he's the winner of the week, and he's been one of the winners of the season, no doubt.
No question about it, man. Let's look at the weekend slate here before we get out. Some really good games coming up. So on Friday, this is a big weekend. Look at this. Thunder Pacers. I feel like that's a really interesting game in large part because the Thunder, are they going to contend? Like, they've been resting guys. The guys have been injured.
Yep.
Like, they kind of could fall out. With one or two more losses, they could fall out of contention for that one seed. And that at Pacers could be a tough one. The Mavericks, who have been on fire, and the Warriors, who have been on fire, a little bit of a clash of the Titans here over the last couple weeks. The Wolves at the Suns, which just like we said with the Thunder, the Wolves have to keep winning. That's a phenomenal matchup. By the way, on this very show, Saul Bookman yesterday said the Suns are going to win by 20, he predicted. So that adds a little spice to that game, at least for me. And then the Spurs and the Pelicans, only because Wembanyama versus Zion, the two weirdest bodied impact players in all of the NBA going head to head, is always fun.
Yeah, great slate. Gonna be. I had a friend ask me last night, how long have they been doing this play-in tournament? And I was explaining to him how long it's been around and what I like about it, and the way that we have like races to watch in different parts of both conferences now is so fun. So these last couple of weeks of the NBA season have so much more weight than they've had in previous years. It's a blast that there's, you know, four or five really meaningful matchups seemingly every night now.
Every night, except for Saturday, because of course we have March Madness Final Four, which will kind of take center stage. That should be great. NC State, Purdue, UConn versus Alabama. But on Sunday, the NBA takes center stage once again. They're off Monday, so you got to Friday and Sunday, they put a lot of good games on. So let's look at Sunday, Heat at Pacers. This one has playoff position or play-in positioning implications. You've got the Knicks and the Bucks. That'll be an interesting one, especially for the Knicks. They still have a chance to catch the Bucks. If you win that one, it actually becomes a conversation. The Wolves play the Lakers. That's another one that'll be big for the Wolves and for the Lakers, to be honest with you. It's big for both teams. 76ers, Spurs, Embiid versus Wemby, another one that is just fun. And then the Pelicans at Suns, which is, by the way, Pelicans at Suns, currently tied in the standings. So that one could be big for avoiding the play, and that game will go a really long way. Look at how many great games, not good games, great games there are this weekend, Andy.
Loaded. You're going to have lots of homework to do, Adam.
I thought I had a little weekend off. You can cue that outro music, Emma. I thought, man, this last couple of weeks has been such a grind, but it's one of those things that reminds you, this time of year, it's all grind, baby. All gas, no brakes, straight all the way till the end of June. Andy, thank you so much for joining on, man. Always fun when you hop on.
Thanks as always for having me, Adam. You're the best.
Check him out at Bleacher Report or on Twitter, or x.com, where you can see him always sharing lots of good stats, lots of good details and everything else. Guys, that wraps it up for the week. Thank you so much for watching. Hit that like button on the way out. Legs are back on Monday. We'll see you then.